The neighbors used to call the cops on us at least 2 times a week. The other 5 were the days that we quit drinking. I was only happy when I was with her. We only drank when we were together. Sometimes I needed to work, sometimes she needed to paint. I remember those days, sitting in the back of a white van, driving from Long Island City to Wall Street, carrying ladders and curtains down alleys to service elevators, watching for the sun to do its revolution over the Empire State Building, drowning itself in the Hudson, finally allowing me to drive turnpikes and parkways to get home to her. She'd wake up at 5 or 6 from October to April. I don't think she ever saw the sun. We stole cat food so we had money for weed. We didn't eat because of the cocaine, but I kept working and she kept sleeping. My parents wanted to know why she didn't get a job. How could I explain the obvious? She was too beautiful for work, for orders, for discipline. And for a girl who knows this, there's no such thing as enough. My back hurt all the time from the grind. My face hurt all the time from her fists. I'll never live with a Puerto Rican again. When she got bored, she left. When she got angry, she hit. We fought hard. We'd make up hard. The neighbors called the law for both. Each would leave me bleeding and bruised. And when the cops showed up, it was hard to explain that I was actually having the best time of my life.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Scott Laudati. Scott is a writer and a musician. Scott, great having you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for being on. Your art's really cool. So.
Oh, sweet. Thanks. That's always good to hear.
You've written several books. Your latest release is Play the Devil, which came out a few weeks ago. How did you come about to writing this book? Is it a memoir?
No, it's not a memoir. It's kind of like loosely based on like my time in New Jersey and my friends there. But it's like it's fiction. I mean, I was a pool boy for one summer and I kind of made the two main characters pool boys, and it's sort of told like through a day cleaning pools, but it's more about like New Jersey and politics, and it's a love story and everything else, I guess.
I actually on my parents' side, my mom grew up in Kearney, New Jersey. Are you near Kearney? Yeah. I've only been there like a couple of times, but when we have the chance, other than see my on my grandma's side in Bluefield, sometimes over there, we also we'll go around Cherry Hill and then obviously the beach locations like Wildwood or Ocean City, because I'm in the Pennsylvania area. So I only know New Jersey as being this kind of isolated state that has its own unique culture to it. But yeah, there's a lot to say about that on suburban areas. I mean, there's one of the other one of our other hosts. He's in New Brunswick, actually.
Sure.
And
sorry.
No, well, recently I was in Edgewater, New Jersey, but that's right next to New York City, and that's like mainline Jersey, so that doesn't really compare to some other suburban area of Jersey where it's literally just out in a forest, but...
Well, I'm from like Bruce Springsteen, New Jersey.
Okay.
Bloomfield, real quick. So my mom's maiden name, well, her grandfather was Bloomfield, and the town is named after them, and if I'd gotten the grades, I could have gone to Rutgers for free because of that. But my grades were terrible, so I didn't get into Rutgers. But it would have been there's like some old New Jersey thing, like if you're a relative of a Bloomfield, you get to go to Rutgers for free. Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty. I mean, I just recently graduated to college a few days ago. I actually graduated college with a double major, and I've been to like 4 different institutions from state, mainline, community college, and just average school. But I've spent some time there, and I've understood kind of the class difference. I can totally understand where it's definitely a struggle to, and class differences, especially from in any state-wise and culture. I understand too of in your book, Play the Devil, I was actually reading some of it. You mentioned Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.
Yeah.
How much of that is influenced in your work of, where are the external influences going on? Is it more on the Jack Kerouac side or more on the Upton Sinclair side? Or,
well, I would say, writing wise, Jack Kerouac's my favorite writer. I know how that sounds, and there's like a face everybody makes when I say that. But Upton Sinclair, politically, that like kind of changed the whole game for me when I read The Jungle for the first time. They make you read it in like seventh grade, but they leave out the whole end where he kind of sees the benefit of the union, and like the light kind of comes in through the cellar, and so it does end on an optimistic note, even though it's like 700 pages of horror before that. But I kind of got into radical politics immediately after reading The Jungle, but I don't write in that way. I write more of like a free flowy Kerouac kind of way.
And I like your design on the book. It's very psychedelic. You have this picture with a gun, and it sort of has a little psychedelic thing, but also looks like it could sort of be a blood stain over the writing.
Yeah.
On the cover.
The this guy Carlos, he designed. So Kubowa Press published my two published books. I had a book of poetry published by them like 2 years ago, and he did the cover on that one, and it was like pretty psychedelic too, which I dug. And actually at first I didn't like it, but then I heard good things, and then I kind of like started to dig it a lot. And so I wanted him to do the new cover, and he threw in like the pink splotches and stuff. I think it makes it stand out, which is cool. Cause nobody I know really reads, but they still buy books. So it'll look cool, at least on like a coffee table or something.
I mean, I love reading. I have a bizarre selection of books. We were actually talking on Twitter. I know you like Cameron Pierce, right? Some of the bizarro fiction. And
yeah, I like. I don't like bizarro that much, but I do like some lazy fascist stuff. I like Sam Pink. I think he's pretty cool. Yeah,
he's really cool too. I mean,
is there an element of bizarro fiction in your work?
No, not at all. I never really was exposed to any of that kind of stuff until I dated this girl and made me read Sam Pink like 3 years ago. And that kind of opened me up to Scott McClanahan and like indie lit that I really didn't even know was happening. I never really was into sci-fi or bizarro. But after listening to your podcast with Cameron Pierce, I like got really interested in it. So it's definitely on my reading list to dive into some of that stuff.
Yeah, can you talk more about the political themes in Play the Devil?
Yeah. I think now we're confronted with this mirror that like the American dream has died, or it never existed in the first place. So you have people my age, millennials, I guess. And we've known kind of is losing and lost the whole, like everybody's in debt, everybody's in college debt, we're never going to own houses. So this book is kind of like graduating from college and not being able to get a job and having to go home and work the same stupid job you had when you were 15. Kind of coming to grips with like that's probably going to be the rest of your life.
You said in the book, I was reading one chapter, it said, quote, the next 60 years would start just like this, as if you lived in the suburbs or a Mizwet's town or stuck in the doldrums. It seems like there's some, even in the poetry book, Hawaiian Shirts, there's that reoccurring theme of the doldrum question, as if there's this nihilistic, is it really doom and gloom, or is this something of a phase, or I don't know, is this how bad is this influence among millennials being getting out of college and starting that year zero and not going anywhere?
I think the more dangerous part is kind of this environment that we're coddled in, that like, you know, it's going to work out. Like, just keep trying a little harder, because it pits parents against kids, like, because parents are like, you know, in my day, we worked hard.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, so now everybody I know is working two or three jobs. They're working 60-something hours a week. They're not accomplishing anything. I mean, everybody I know is a great guitar player, a great writer, but nobody has time to do any of this stuff. And so I think, and especially with this election that just happened, like, you know, you'd say like, you know, I think Trump's going to win this thing. If you spent any time in between New York and California, this wouldn't have been so much of a shock. And then, you know, you have people who are like, oh my God, don't say that. Or like, there's no way this is ever going to happen. And then it happened. So I think there's a major, maybe like nihilistic awakening that's happening where people are kind of being confronted with their own bullshit now. There's been a mirror turned on everybody.
Pilliter, didn't you say that your area in Pennsylvania, did you notice that trend with the working class and Trump?
That they were, well, certainly in my area, I mean, one, Pennsylvania is a Trump state, and it's ironic because it's been Democratic for a very long time and liberal, yet everywhere you go outside of Philadelphia, it's pretty much pro-Trump, and that there's this kind of that, you know, you people want to have work or they want to have some kind of sustainable living. It seems today that, you know, we're told that, you know, going to college or investing in time in youth, you end up wasting it, and then you end up existing now and you spend your money, and then you're living, as you said, a doldrum, and you're not moving anywhere. It's kind of scary to think that because, one, you know, right now I'm kind of out of school. I'm just waiting for my bachelor degree now. And so either my answer would be, do I have to get into grad school, which seems most likely, or would I just have to go out and find work and make a career of myself and do these things? And there's also true kind of the third position where I know, like, you know, like Harlan Venison or Robert and Human, where they're more of this nomadic punk lifestyle. And they're this strange. And so I was thinking back on Scott. Scott, are you more of the nomad or into the, how should I say? Because there's this whole lifestyle, too, where it's like you just drop out of the whole bourgeois way of living. And then you just live at people's houses or something.
I failed out of community college or quit. I mean, a ton of times before I ended up graduating from a real college. But in between all that time, I was just kind of like driving back and forth to California or like guitar tagging for bands and going around the country. And now I'm 30 and I'm just scared all the time that I'm just going to be fucking poor forever. Or like my girlfriend is going to think I'm a loser, you know? So that's kind of just the influence of my life now, just like a perpetual fear of, because if you fail here, you're totally screwed. Like there's nothing to fall back on. Everybody tells you it's your fault. So I don't know. I keep coming to these crossroads. Like, should I keep writing? Should I keep playing music? What are we doing?
I mean,
what are we accomplishing?
You had actually a poem.
I haven't dropped out yet, but I think that dropping out is probably as smart of an idea as going to grad school and continuing on.
Yeah, like, I can understand. If you have access, if you have like literally a trust fund in the back of your living on $1 million, either you live on $1 million on exotic island or you keep doing things which the wealthy have, and that's most people have. But the thing is, it's sad because the old cliche is the poor get poorer, the rich get richer. I mean, you had also a poem about being 30 on the Stockholm Review.
Yeah.
Not to say that there was a nihilistic tone to it or I don't know. It's something about aging that, not to bring up midlife crisis.
Well, yeah. I mean, I haven't read that yet, but I should. I'm 31, so I should read that. Like a quarter. Is it like the concept of like a quarter life crisis? If you heard of that?
And actually, you know, Kerouac kind of writes about that. He mentions it in On the Road too. It's I don't know, between like 27 and 31, it's kind of this like what was cute and cool to like throw abandon, you know, to the wind and just ride it and see what happens. Like all of a sudden, those friends who didn't do it now have, you know, kids and houses, and you really start to see things pulling in opposite directions. But what were you going to say about the poem in the Stockholm Review? I'm sorry.
No, I just thought it was, I liked it. I mean, about being 30. It's, you know, I'm in my early 20s, but sooner or later, everyone is going to be a certain age. But to me, if you think about it, being 30 is still young. It's not like you're going to, like when people say midlife crisis, sometimes someone is 30 and they go, I have a midlife crisis, as opposed that you're going to die at 60, or opposed that, because I think always officially midlife crisis was 50, because supposedly you live a good life and you live to 100 or late 90 or something like that. But right. It seems like you could have midlife crisis at 25, 27, and then die at 50 or something really strange.
It is like when you're like a teenager, you have this dream of what your life is going to be like at, say, 30. And then you get to that point and you kind of like reality sits in and you think like, this is it. Is this going to be my life for like forever?
Yeah, and we don't even get that now. Like, is this going to be my life forever? Because we don't have anything at 30. So it's like, I wish I could have that fear, like, you know, oh my God, is this mundane existence going to be my reality? It's like, I can't even, you know, like paying rent is an accomplishment. So, and I just moved from New York to LA. So it's like a little bit less of an accomplishment, but it's still, you still have to work forever, you know?
Is Hunter S. Thompson an influence from that style? Because he was older and he basically called himself a doctor, even though he just did. He was older, but lived his life as a youthful, like free agent, you know, kind of like that, the blaring the lines between like, who says that if you're in your early teens and early 20s, you therefore have the greatest time of your life, when in fact, what if it just happens later on in life, you know? Well, so as long as you don't die. Rum Diary? What's that?
Sorry, have you ever read The Rum Diary?
Not really, no.
So that's his first book. It's all right, but almost the entire theme of the book is I'm over the hump. I lost. I'm losing. I'm too old. You know, and he was, I think, like 31 when he wrote that.
I read Hell's Angels, and I liked that one, and some of his are one. Like, you know, you read Kentucky Derby is depraved, and some of the other, but Thompson reminds me of that style where you're just, not to advocate like doing drugs and just living out your own life, but kind of just making your own space and doing your own thing and just living by that.
Yeah. I was going to mention one other thing about, like what you were saying about the trust fund and stuff before. So I just lived in New York City for, 7 years, and it becomes this strange reality because you're trying to be like an artist or a writer and you don't have any money, but you're surrounded by all these people with trust funds. But they all want to slum it, and because they like art and art's sexy and it's cool. So they, you know, they wear the clothes and they rip holes in their jeans. And, but then they get to grow out of it. Like I saw so many girls, especially come up from, you know, Miami or whatever. And, they're super pretty. And then they put on the bohemian clothes and they do that for a while. Then you think you're around all this money. So it's just like, you're kind of waiting for it to sort of cross over and then it never does. And then they eventually go back home and, you know, live their lives and you still have no money and you're still, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. You basically like right now I'm back at home myself, but during when I started about 5-6 years ago, I went from music major to Asian studies to communications and ending up a double major in English and communications, and did 4 different places because I was all over the place. And then I realized, you know what? I really only liked hanging out in Philadelphia for Asian studies, and realizing in term, it's like, you know what? Not to be regretting and huge, you know, you have that slice of life in English. If only I could have that as an extended time. But when the clock hits 12, it's all over. And then you start back.
Yeah. I think with, obviously, I mean, people in other countries, they're poor, but they kind of accept that that's their life. They're born into like some poor village and that's it. We're kind of conditioned in this country with the media and the culture that everyone is going to like, you're from children are told to kind of pursue their dreams, and like the media portrays these certain lifestyles, and we have like these images of what our lives should be, and people are sort of conditioned to strive for that. So if they don't achieve their goals or fantasies or whatever you want to call them, they're going to feel pretty shitty.
Yeah. And then everybody's going to think that you're an idiot for rolling the dice. You know, when you could have just done something guaranteed, which doesn't really even exist anymore. But like my dad, for instance, he would, you know, so I was a journalism major. And he was like, I don't know why you're majoring in journalism. Journalism's over. You know, and I was like, well, I think it's important that like people like me who care about this stuff do it, you know, but yeah, I was never able to get a job in it. And I don't even know what the journalists in our country do anymore. They don't tell the news. So at the end of it, he was right. Like, I fought him. I got the degree. I tried really hard. I didn't get the job. And now I'm like, damn, like, he was right for all the wrong reasons, which drives me crazy.
Huh.
You know?
Do you know of Jim Goad?
I don't know who that is, no.
Okay, Jim Goad. He got his degree in journalism some time back, but he had a punk zine called Answer Me back in like the mid-90s. It was really controversial shock art. He later, however, you know, after being the celebrity who he is, Jim Goad, he's now actually kind of putting that use to journalism now just for writing articles on Talkie Mag. He's been on the Stark Truth like twice, and he's kind of well known because it's like now like magazine outlets like Vice with Gavin McInnes, you know, doing his own.
Yeah.
Goad actually accidentally invented the whole punk journalism thing, and basically, but the thing was, it was unintentional, right? It basically was basically his skill of journalism, but with the whole Thompson Gonzo style of just being, I don't know, Goad has a very unique style, and I think it does pay off later on. So it's like, I think like if your degree of journalism, even though it might not give you a profession or a job, it's definitely going to influence the style of how you think about things and the world.
Sure.
And I always think like it means something in the end, and it doesn't really, it's not like I'm saying I'm kind of the optimist. I don't like to believe it's like, it's all nihilistic and worthless in the end, unless it's like general studies, you know, or some kind of bland degree without a name. So as long as it has a name, it means something to you as a person, or what you were trying, that your intentions were.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I don't know. It is important. Everybody should do what they care about. I don't know, or like, that's, I mean, it's crazy that we're kind of entering this time where you have to like put that stuff aside so you are guaranteed a job somewhere. I mean, if you look at the current state of our media right now, like, this is, I feel like, the result of that kind of thinking. Like, there's a few different organizations. Like, if you looked at my Facebook wall during this election, you would think that Hillary was going to win by 100%, you know? Mm-hmm. And
were you for a particular candidate or just like a pessimist?
No, I mean, I was like for Bernie. The only time I haven't voted for the socialist is I voted for Ron Paul a couple years ago, like, I don't know, 8 years ago. But other than that, I've kind of always been on the edge of the left, I guess. But so I did end up voting for Hillary in the end. I didn't feel good about it. I still kind of am haunted that I voted for Hillary Clinton, but whatever. She didn't win anyway, so who cares?
No, it's funny because about like 4 years ago, I voted for Gary Johnson. And in my early years, I was a part of the PSL, Party of Socialism and Liberation, just to join the club. It's not like I was a forefront advocate of socialism. It was just something of out of interest, you know? It seems like...
Sure.
People today, it's like you either vote this or you're that, and then you make alliance to that. So if you're for Clinton, you gotta be a pro Clinton, even though it might be.
Yeah, with the political ideology, you have to like adopt all the positions of the ideology, like it's a religion or of a political party, instead of just thinking for yourself, looking at each issue on a case by case basis. Are you familiar with this movement called the alt-left?
Yeah, I am. I think it, I don't know. I think it's pretty ridiculous. Also, this idea of liberalism we even have is pretty crazy. I mean, most people I know don't pay any attention to politics in the 4 years between elections. And then for 6 months before it, they become rabid, obsessed. And it's like the amount of people I know who never read a newspaper but were diehard for Hillary Clinton was shocking. And it made me question what, like calling myself a liberal, like if I should ever do that again, you know?
Hilliard, how would you describe like your take on like the alt left, and how would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, not to toot the horn, but I always think Robert Stark's recent programming has been kind of the premier alt left podcast, since that over time, personalities like Rabbit, Bay Area Guy, recently Prince of Queens, our ancient commie, have all basically are now forming through YouTube and blog spots about this ideal called alternative left opposed to alt-right. And it's been said talk, what exactly is it? I mean, Rabbit's view, if you go to altleft.com, he calls it the left-wing faction of the alt-right, meaning that you're quote-unquote red-pilled, you know about reality as a world, but you don't associate with Hitler fetishism or any of the far-right lunacy. And then there's a alt-left of Prince of Queens, where it's just... You were a part of the whole liberal PC culture, or, you know, you might be gay, or you might be a part of the whole, but you don't like the whole social justice warrior culture, this extreme PC or quote unquote cultural Marxism. And then there's another alt left. I think it's more on the Bay Area Guy, where it's like economics based, where it's about kind of the freedom of the individual and what you want to do. And it's not about, like, my argument is that...
What Barry Guy was talking about with the economics and, like, people being in student debt and the living paycheck to paycheck and not being free, that ties in with what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's sure, perfect.
Yeah.
Like, my version of the alt-left, I always think it's like this. People... It's definitely how you look at the old right wing and the new right wing. When you think of the old right wing, you think of National Socialism, fascism. Obviously, that's evil. But today, the alt-right has been able to reform itself where you can disassociate with the past. I think of the alt-left kind of as the same, where look at the past with the foundation of the left was pretty much the French Revolution. Then you had communism. And then there was this post-new left / Frankfurt School. And I think those may be interesting moments in history, but it shouldn't describe the left wing as a whole. And rather, people, I think, go gravitate to the left because the left offers interest to people which you don't commonly find. Like, I always think of friends, family, freedom. Those are three basic things people want, and that's what the left offers. And I always think, you know, you also have to be very critical, like, about things. Like, you have to think about, is egalitarianism or equality a good thing? And you might have to argue whether, depending what you mean by that. And so I think the alt-left is critical itself on the left. And so just like the alt-right, it's just a reformist party, basically, of how do you make a meaningful left wing that anybody would want to associate with. But it's interesting to think about.
Well, I think that, I mean, countries like Sweden, you know, Norway, Denmark, like, those are countries I think to strive for. It serves a country to have all of its citizens educated. It does not. It serves the power to have everybody in debt, but it doesn't serve the good of the nation. So, you know, I backpacked Europe when I was like 7. So my dad was like a FDNY, and so I left, like, you know, kind of being like, yeah, go America, you know, the Iraq war rules, like, we're kicking ass, we're Americans. And then when I got to Europe and I saw, like, the standard of living everybody over there, I realized that we were doing something horribly wrong and we were being lied to. And then as I got further into Denmark or maybe Austria, I can't remember, one of those countries, I was blown away by, like, the services. Like, I mean, everybody was healthy. They, you know, their food quality is way better. Nobody's in debt. everybody was happy. Like, everybody was sitting at a cafe, drinking coffee, reading books, like stuff that you never really see here.
And you kind of talk about this in your book, Play the Devil, about Jersey is just kind of the mundane life of like commercial shopping centers and places like Home Depot.
Yeah.
And the way like cities function, that plays a major role in it as well.
And Dunkin' Donuts too.
Lots of Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. New Jersey is a completely insular place. You, nobody from New Jersey ever leaves New Jersey. Even when I moved to New York and, I was trying to get my friends to come visit. I was like, you know, I live in New York City now. Come hang out. They're like, oh, I don't want to go to New York. There's no parking, or like, you know, fuck New York or whatever. Like, it's – people love Jersey, and they love staying in New Jersey, and they love having opinions on everywhere else. But, you know, people from New Jersey only go to Myrtle Beach or Florida, and that's it.
Huh. It's kind of like –
I'm from LA and I live fairly close. You just moved out there. What have been some of your overall impressions?
The people here are so much nicer than I've ever been led to believe. Everybody always talk. It's like, you know, it's either New York or LA, and New York people always say LA is so fake and all the people are, you know, everybody's trying to be an actor or whatever. So they're all, you know, trying to cut each other down and get somewhere. But all I found is pretty much like refugees from the Midwest and whatever. And everybody's super nice and super supportive. Like, I don't know anybody out here. I ended up at a Friendsgiving with a friend's friend, and everybody was just so nice. So the people here are way nicer than the people in New York, for sure. So that's cool. That was unexpected.
We did touch upon your art. Can you talk more about your artwork? I'm an artist as well.
You mean like writing and music?
Yeah, writing, music, and do you do visual art or just the
No, I made a couple of videos, like music. So if you go on YouTube and Google me, I made some music videos for some of the poems from my first book. So like I do a little bit
of cover for the Hawaiian shirts and the electric chair book on poetry.
Yes. So I did like four poems from Hawaiian shirts and electric chair. I made music videos for. I'm a terrible painter and drawer, so I don't do that. I have a cousin. His name is Drew Ennis. He's a great artist, so he and I will collaborate on stuff a lot.
Yeah, the cover has a very like 70s feel to it.
Yeah. He didn't do that. The publisher, this guy, so Kubowa is run by a guy named Pablo Dester. His brother Carlos does all this stuff, and working with them is really cool because Pablo is like he's like an old punk rocker. So he's all like, there's no contracts, there's no weirdness. Anytime I have a question, I just hit him up, and everything's like very in-house. Like, we're all super close and tight. So that's been really well, because I've heard a lot of like horror stories with people signing their art away.
I like the stop motion nature where there was a bunch of He-Man figures and what was that one? And the one with the Garden East of Eden, which is that your boxer, by the way?
Yeah, and you know, she just died, and that's why I moved to California.
Okay.
She's a boxer. She was around for like 10 years. She was my best friend. I think we were telepathic. So it really sucks losing her. Yeah.
I have two dogs myself, and I can understand being a dog person is very of a, because there's a lot of focus in that video on the dog, and I think that's super cute. But
yeah, she, I mean, I've written, you know, essays about getting her, and I was with this girl when I got her, and like the relationship pretty much ended because of the dog. She was my best friend.
On an old article called On Working at Barnes and Nobles, you talk about Pomeranian dogs and writing for that or something. I don't know, just to bring up some weird that there's a dog theme going on. I don't know.
Yeah. I'd much rather hang out with dogs than people. Like, it's the best surprise when I go to a party and there's a cool dog, because that's how I'll spend like my 3 hours petting the dog.
I noticed you even wrote about a George Bush's dog.
Man, you're digging into the archives. Yeah. His Scotty, yeah. I don't know. The article's about what he... I don't know. I found him to be so fascinating because he was like this moronic, you know, figure. And then he disappears and he comes back as a Renaissance man. I mean, now he's a painter and his paintings just keep getting better, which is crazy.
Say that so, George Bush in that The Most Interesting Man in the World, you say, could this be further evidence of his self-doubt or the unsure nature we feel from his paintings? Or has George Bush have taken notes from outside or underground, like artists like Bansky, letting hype and mystery surround his art to boost publicity? As if now there's some...
It's almost like a performance art piece, is his life, you know?
You know, I know what you're saying. It's like Jeb Bush. Now imagine if the election was coming down to Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. That would be, I don't know.
Like the two most boring people imaginable. Yeah,
nobody would need Ambien anymore. Everybody would just go to sleep.
And if Jeb was supposedly to win, he would continue the Bush legacy, but he'd be even more geekier and even more horrible than original Bush. So it's like, but at the same time, there's a redemption. It's this strange, like, you might hate him, but in the end you love him or something really strange. I don't know, like you just said.
Yeah, and George Bush is really smart because unlike everybody else, he just, like, you know, this is a guy who should have been hung for war crimes, but he just shut up and, like, went away. And now, after 8 years, he's kind of – we kind of look at him as this, like, I don't know. It's like this guy, it's not really his fault. You know, he's our friend. He meant well, but he's an idiot, so he doesn't know what he's doing, you know?
Even, like, I hear liberals apologizing for Bush now, like Bill Maher, like, oh, Trump is so scary, like, I kind of like George Bush now.
Right. He just didn't put his foot in his mouth. He just went away, and time healed all his wounds. It's crazy. Yeah.
You've also there's another archive article, which I actually found fascinating, about Super Mario Brothers reptilian rape in the Hollow Earth theory, where you go about David Icke's reptilian theory and has something to do about Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, I don't, this was, I don't know. I was really subscribing to this reptilian agenda for a while, and I'm not, like...
Oh, the whole David Icke thing, yeah.
Yeah, and, I don't know. It seems like these people just really are fueled only by, like, misery and destroying the environment. And so I don't know.
David Icke actually takes the whole lizard thing literally. He puts it out as a literal theory, but it could be seen as a metaphor.
Or it could be literal. I don't know. I was reading some article, like, the last queen of England who died, that she had to be buried in, or they would put her in, like, a 12-foot casket, and, like, eyewitness reports that they couldn't fit her tail into the casket.
Oh. I mean, David Icke's pretty cool. I mean, I will be honest. I loved reading Icke when in community college, when I first started. I actually sourced Icke on something. It was a long time ago, but I really like some of his logic. I mean, other than, I don't know, it's really interesting, Icke. A lot of people say he's some kook, but if you really listen to him, he does have, like, logical and sound arguments, and you really believe him in the end once you get into it.
Dude, especially at 3 a.m, man, it starts to make an awful lot of sense.
I love his theory about money, where he says that money is just a number in our head and a figment of our imagination. So as long as the physical form is there, we believe money exists, when in reality we can bend the rules and make up literally a $1,000 bill if we can press it. And then so as long as the authority says so. But that's like a classical Icke theory. I mean,
yeah. Well, I like anybody like him who promotes this agenda of, like, you know, of the people versus the establishment or whatever. Like, he's not – nothing he said – people, I mean, get angry and irate about David Icke, but, like, all he's saying is like, the people – like, us, you know, the bottom 99%. It's like we're all in this together. We're all part of this. He's not – nothing he's saying is bad for us, you know? So this rabid, like, response to David Icke, I never understood. Or any of those people. Russell Brand's The Trues. Like, people get crazy about that. All this guy's doing is spending his time trying to show us how badly we're getting screwed, you know?
In the context of Super Mario Brothers, would that be an abstract, friendlier version of understanding maybe Icke's theory in a video game sense, or...
Honestly, I We were doing we were recording a record when we first all got in. We started listening to Coast to Coast AM a lot, and then reading David Icke. And then
wasn't Mishlove a guest in that show? With
yes, he was. Yes, yeah, yeah. We had Jeffrey Mishlove on the show a few, and he has his program called Thinking Aloud, and he does New Thinking Aloud. But yeah, he was on Coast to Coast.
Oh yeah, I mean that show is great. Every time I'm like cooking dinner or whatever, I have like 20 minutes. I put them on, and but anyway, I can't even remember your question now.
We were just saying that were you playing Super Mario Brothers, and it just a light bulb popped in your head, and you're like, you know what? I'm fighting Koopas. Yeah, yeah.
We all ate Molly to like get into the zone or whatever, and then we were playing Mario Kart, and then I was just like, "Wow, look at Bowser, man! He's the head reptile. We got to save the Peach."
That's
you know,
awesome. Yeah, I like that. That's kind of the experimental writing I actually like to write, and it's something of I like that stuff is because I wish more of it was there, and people will call you crazy at first and say that that's not true, but so as long as you like deconstruct the text and mean it what you want to say, you can pretty much say what you want, you know. And it's I like stuff like it reminds me of I think it's the comedy duo Tim and Eric. Supposedly yeah. their yeah. thesis, their graduate thesis was lobsters in popular medium or something like that, and they only talk about, I don't know if it was real or not, but supposedly it's this article where they say that here are all the lobsters in popular movie, television, music, and like the lobster animal. I just think that's pretty cunning and funny, but interesting. But if you're really sophisticated about it, it makes sense, you know, if you literally like lobsters.
That's I don't know anything about this. I have to read into that. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was, can you talk about how you got into music?
Yeah. I grew up in Staten Island, which is in like a super Italian Catholic, like really strict, whatever. And but I had a neighbor who was Jewish and went to public school. And I went over to his house when I was 8. And he had just gotten a hold of Kerplunk from yes. Green Day's second record. And he played me that. And I was just like, wow, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. And so then I was just kind of like strumming on guitars or whatever. And I mean, I really like, you know, like Bright Eyes and Connor Oberst are probably my favorite band and songwriter ever, but I listen to everything, but I mean, I still listen to punk rock religiously, like I have since I was 9 years old. You know, I think it's the ultimate form of music.
My older brother, he's into hardcore, but I never was really into the that kind of stuff. I mean, as for pop punk wise, I do like Reggie and the Full Effect and everything. Yes. Everything they would play on MTV's Undergrads cartoon show and like corny stuff like that. I do like some of that.
What was that record? Songs Not to Get Married To?
Yes.
That Reggie record? That's awesome, man. That record rules.
Yes, I do. They're that kind of very clever stuff I do like when I think of pop punk. A very populated, unlike noisy hardcore music, if you're talking about like Wolf Eyes or something where it's just noise and it's just like a harsh underground.
I've never been like I feel like I've never been angry enough for like hardcore and stuff like that. Like I like I always like punk, like, you know, fuck you, you're not controlling my life, more so than like because when I was growing up in New Jersey, the punk scene was enormous, but there was also like the weird hardcore scene, and then there was like the skinhead, like the racist skinheads.
Yeah. Oh yeah, like One Life Crew and
so you wrote this article Staring Into the Sun, and this can you talk about that article? The sun gazing.
Yeah.
Sun gazing is something that I guess some people, it's in East, like Indian spirituality. I think it's goes back to like ancient Egypt and it's popular in India, but there's people who believe they can get this like spiritual power from the sun, but a lot of people have obviously been blinded by it as well.
Apparently you can eat the sun if you do this right and you stare at it long enough. You don't even need to eat, you can just you know, you're like, you become like a plant, I guess, almost.
Have you tried it?
No, I haven't tried it. We tried it for like this was all this and the reptilian agenda and all that stuff was kind of like the same period of just you know, I don't know, the Arab Spring was happening, like all this like seemingly enlightenment stuff was happening, and we were like in my friend's parents' basement trying all this stuff. So no, I never ate the sun.
What I remember from, I think it's called breathism. I think on the Wikipedia page for that, I don't know if I'm saying the word right, but it's just, I remember reading about it, and it's just like people who only rely on the sun as a nutritional value. And I always think that's really hard to do because you have to suntan all the time or do it a correct way. I don't understand. I've never seen, I have to see a documentary on it, but yeah, I think it is interesting and maybe esoteric in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it worked for, you know, like you get a reptile and you feed it some lettuce, but it just sits under that heat lamp all day and it triples in size in a year, you know? So I guess it probably works, but I'm not an expert, so I don't know.
You've also recently this year, you've also written an article about waiting in line for the NoFX book signing. And that seemed to be, once again, the Kerouac style of writing where it's just, or the Gonzo Journal, where you're just waiting in line for a book signing, right?
Yeah. So their book is awesome. I mean, I laughed out loud for endless pages at a time. However, that book signing sucked. Like you waited online forever and then you were kind of rushed through to just sort of like wait, like the hot girls got to like stand in front of NoFX and talk to them for like 2 seconds, but everybody else just kind of got rushed through. So yeah, that was that.
Is it more about, sorry.
Can you talk about your postcard poems for anyone who buys the book?
Yeah. So when my grandfather passed, everybody was going, we were trying to, so he lived in Cairo for a long time and he had a really cool collection of all this stuff. But I guess what they used to do would be like collect postcards, and they had like postcard photo albums. And nobody could like really figure out what to do with them. They were going to get thrown out. But I was like, all these postcards from the 50s and 60s are amazing. They're like, they're all art pieces. So I grabbed them and then I was like, what am I going to do with, I had like 1,000 postcards.
These are from like all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah. They, most of them date from like the 40s to the 70s, I would say. And there's like this really cool, I don't know if it's like Art Deco, but it's like, the postcards were definitely done differently back then. There was like an artistic element to them. So yeah, I'll put like half of a poem on a postcard and send it out to people as like a thank you for buying the book. And it's kind of cool because then people get it and then they'll Instagram it because it like photographs really well. And so it's like a kind of like an endless marketing stream that really doesn't cost me anything, but is a cool thing for everybody to have. So that's been very beneficial.
Is your work more related or have an influence with the nature of punk zines or the DIY kind of book scene?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, almost everything that I write and create is like, is punk, man. Like I'd be these postcards too. It's like, I'll slap whiteout on it and then write on top of the whiteout. So it looks almost like cutout, like punk zine stuff. Back when I was saying before in the old scene, I guess, I don't know if they, I never really, every now and then I'll go to a punk show still, like for like high school bands and stuff. It doesn't really seem like kids make zines anymore, I guess because they all have blogs, but back when I was going to shows in high school, like, you know, there'd be a couple zines that were making the rounds, and it was all that, like cut out kind of, I don't know, William S. Burroughs sort of look to it, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, compared to like, you know, there's the established books where, you know, you buy a book for research or old classical fiction, but there's now this whole book scene where, you know, like the whole Sam Pink or Gary Shipley, where it's more based upon the cover of the book and the whole bizarro fiction coming in, especially with punk scenes. There's like, yeah, there's such limited qualities, limited to 100, limited to this much. They're very cheap and affordable, and rather you enjoy it for the aesthetics of art. But for your own writing, would you say, how do you balance that between aesthetics-wise of owning an art piece compared to an impactful and important message, what you have to say in Play to Devil, even in your poetry? Referring
particularly to the book covers.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying relating to the text compared to the text that can have a cool, impactful meaning on somebody compared to, you know, also as well the covers and somebody who would, like you just said, Robert.
Yeah. Well, the covers, I feel like, have to – we're past this point where people it's all got to look like an art piece. So I feel like the colors matter, the design matters. And then as far as the interior, though, I mean, I just wrote, like, the story. Like, I just wanted to make it the best I could. And then to get people to buy it, like, I pretty much just sell it at cost. Like, I think I make, like, 11 cents off every book sold because – I mean, I'd rather people buy. If you get a book off for $10 off Amazon, then after shipping and everything, it's like $16. That's a lot of money. I mean, that's 2.5 hours of somebody's like work day, you know. So,
do you use self-publishing or do you publish with a publishing company?
No, both of my books are published by Kubowa Press. It's run by this guy Pablo out of Lancaster. So he's been publishing books for. A decade or so. So they're not self-published, but he's really cool. He gets these books made for like $380 a copy. The novel is a little bit more expensive because it's like 300 pages. But so after that, he'll sell it, and then we'll take like the dollar profit it's made, and then just we'll split that. So I'll have like. So after I sell 10 copies, I'll run like a Facebook ad about it or whatever. But it's like a one step above self-publishing, you know. But he does all the publishing. I have no idea how he gets these books made for so cheap or anything like that.
Yeah, we seem to be also in a generation or market today where you could sit down and read, William Shakespeare in a boring looking book and appreciate literature from if you understand it, opposed to that if you read like Sam Pink, where it's just all over the place and represents this kind of aesthetic pleasing nature to it. So I'm actually writing a book too, and just putting a bunch of memoirs in there about my own life in the past few years, and you could flip to any page and read about it. Like a coffee table book. And, at the same time, if the book was to be published, I think always to myself that, the cliche they tell you that, don't judge a book by its cover. But it seems to me that we're in an era where it's like, judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, you better have the best cover on the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, for the book I'm working on, I'm already like talking to an artist about commissioning a piece for it.
Yeah, I mean, you should definitely be thinking about that in the early stages. I don't know. It's tough. I have no idea what makes something sell and doesn't. I got really, really lucky because I sent this novel, Play the Devil. I mean, it probably got rejected by, 300 places. And then somebody picked it up when we signed a contract. And then they went out of business. And then Kubowa said that they would like, they would like to print it. And so they did. And self-publishing is cool too. Like if you know how to use the internet, there's no reason to have a publisher. Cause what are you going to get? A $2,000 advance. And then you're going to have to pay all that back before you make any profit anyway. So what's the point?
I know there's like some of those independent publishers that some of them don't charge at all, or they charge like a very small fee.
Well, like Lulu?
Yes, I was just thinking about that.
Yeah. There's like 9 banded books. I'm not sure if what they charge, but that's one of them. I know that Anne Scherzinger has her Hopeless Books. She actually doesn't charge at all. That's what she says in her blog.
I mean, that seems to be the way to go. I know I was trying to get this book published by Tyrant, and it ended up getting rejected. But I think that I knew somebody who worked there, and he said they give like a $2,000 advance, which is sick. But then after that, it's like you still, if you know how to use Instagram and Twitter and all that stuff yourself, I mean, now we're at a point where, you know, who cares, like, who your publisher is? Nobody reads you cares. So,
you know what you could do? If you had a YouTube personality and had at least 1,000 or more subscribers, you could sell your book on Lulu and most likely get 50 hits of someone buying your book on Lulu. So as long as the medium's out there. So that's very interesting to think about, too, in a time. And I would actually highly consider Lulu, just for the sake that I know a small number of people are going to read it. And that also builds a resume. So in the future, when you tell other booking companies why they should publish you, you could say, well, I've already have a little online presence here. And you might, you know, something interesting to consider about. But I also...
Definitely.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm also thinking... Sorry.
Is your work geared toward a particular audience?
I mean, I would imagine my reader, I'm really lucky. We're all lucky that we're like, you know, the age we are. Because if we were 16 now and then wanted to be a writer, I don't know who would ever read. You know, I'm 30. So people my age don't really even read, but like people a little bit older than me do. So I can still hopefully kind of tap into that scene. So I don't know. I the themes are sort of millennial, but it kind of like seems like I'm stretching to like anybody who was like around in the 90s also. I don't know.
I also think film is very effective, that if you plan to make music videos or even videos or commercials or YouTube videos just telling to, hey, I have my new book out, you should look at it. Chances are people are going to look at free content more often than taking their chances and giving someone $10 to read a book. They're, you know, they have to give them like information and reason to buy the book or the product before they know. So it's like, I feel like a lot of outside stuff has to be influencing the consumer's purchase in order to buy the book. So if there was like more videos that, like, let's say you do a personal YouTube blog, it's much more people are going to identify you with the book, they're going to buy, and then they'll be interested in reading it. That's, I always think, is an interesting strategy, though.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to be an artist of any medium now, you have to be proficient like across the board with, you know, video, then you need music in your video. You need the writing to be really good on top of all that, which is like the hardest part, but only makes up like 10% of it, you know?
I also think too, it's also true that even that theory may be like a way to get your promotion out. It's so it's never permanent that there's people are going to do that when you do this. And it's like this, I like music, and there's a record shop in Philadelphia, and they only sell like $1.07 for, you know, $1 or like whatever. So you can buy like 12 7-inches for like $8, and they have deals like this, and you discover new music with media nobody wants anymore. The same way, if you lock yourself in a library and you come across an interesting book or have a title, there's some kind of tantalizing nature to medium where you're going to get it. So if I come across your work and I notice that it might have a pretty cover or associated with these authors, or I like what you have to say, chances are I'm going to buy it for some perverted reason that I have, and it's not really based upon a popularity contest. And so there's also that strange thing where getting books is like getting rare records or rare pieces of art too.
Yeah, totally. But it's just people like books. I mean, you go to somebody's apartment, usually there's books displayed, but it's a cool thing to have. It starts conversation. It's definitely a necessity. It's still, I mean, even though, like I said before, nobody reads, like people, I mean, obviously still read, but just having the product is important. Unfortunately, we're competing with like the Hunger Games and Harry Potter, which nobody is embarrassed to display for some reason. But Yeah, it's cool. I mean, people still want the end-all product. So I guess the deal is convincing them that it should be yours. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we'll see. I don't know. I'm not paying my rent with my book sales yet, so I'm probably not the right person to ask.
We are getting towards the end of the show. Where do you see yourself in the future? What are some of your upcoming projects?
Well, real quick, going back to what you said about, like, you know, you can't really guess where, like, the audience is going to be at the time. It's like, when I first came to California, writing books still made sense and people read books. And then the second time it was like books were dead. Everybody's like working on their movie. And now I'm back in California and nobody's working on their movie. Everybody's working on their series that they want to pitch to Netflix or Hulu or whatever. So
you mentioned that because I'm writing a book that Pillater is helping me with. And I mean, this is just kind of a dream, but I'd eventually like to see it get made into like a film.
Sure. I mean, that's the one, obviously, that still people will just sit down and consume it. My point kind of was just like to the amount of years it takes to create something, like you have no idea where everybody is going to be next year or 2 years when it gets finished written and then it gets picked up or whatever. So I'm kind of torn between should I work on writing a movie or should I work on writing another book? Because I mean, how can I guess the audience and where the consumer is going to be in 3 years?
Any screenplays?
I'm about halfway through one right now. I've been watching Harmony Korine and old Spike Lee movies. And I kind
of I love Trash Humpers and I love Julian Dantigly. They're really interesting films too. We don't know whether they're horror or experimental or actually serious films.
Right. Yeah, I just rewatched Gummo again, and I was like, it's awesome. It's genius.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of great stuff in that, too.
Yeah. So that kind of inspired me. I was like, you know, I think I can do this or, like, some version of this. Maybe I should focus the next couple of years on trying to get something like this done. So that's where I'm at right now. I don't know if I'm going to write another book or finish a screenplay.
We are at the end of the show. I'd like to thank Scott Laudati for being on.
Thank you guys for having me. This is my first podcast, but it was really easy to get comfortable, so thanks.
It's been a great show, and also thanks, Pillater.
Awesome. Nice to talk to you.
All right, nice meeting you guys. See you soon.